KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I basically kind of went through the script and was like, this feels like it's written by dudes. Not only that, it feels like it's written by middle-aged dudes, you know, like, or like, this feels a little rapey. You know, like, it would just be like, no, this doesn't feel right.
Blockers, the raunchy but far from mindless tale of three girlfriends who make a pact to lose their virginity on prom night, is comedy writer Kay Cannon's directorial debut. When she was hired for the project, she had some work to do on a script about girls written by a bunch of guys. Cannon tells us how she took a languishing project and turned it into a timely comedy that won raves at South by Southwest. She also recalls an all-night writing session that led to her job on 30 Rock and sticks up for her short-lived, critically reviled Netflix show, Girl Boss. But first on the news banter, Cannon tells Netflix its films can't compete, so Netflix says au revoir to the film festival. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my this week Manhattan buddy in banter, Matt Bellany, who's in New York. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So there is a spat between Netflix and the Cannes Film Festival. Netflix is annoyed because Cannes had said that its films cannot be in competition. So Netflix has retaliated by saying, fine, our films aren't coming at all. And those include high-profile auteur directors, Alfonso Cuarón, Paul Greengrass. There's a film that is an Orson Welles film that was completed by a group including Frank Marshall, the producer. So these are things that I would think audiences would want to see. Cannes is not the most glamorous lineup in history, with the main exception being Young Han Solo coming, which will be very splashy, I'm sure. But, you know, they do have their reasons for pulling out, but it's not great for Netflix.
No, I think both sides are losers in this spat because you have Cannes taking the position that they are protecting the theatrical window, which in France, that's a 36-month theatrical window that movies have to play before they can go to streaming services. That obviously is not acceptable to Netflix, so they're not going to adhere to that. And the festival is essentially saying, we're standing on the side of theaters and not going to allow you into competition. But Netflix has done a lot for Cannes in the past few years. They've brought a bunch of big stars, they've had parties, they've really invested in that festival, and they brought an element of glamour. You know, people on Twitter have been complaining this year about the lack of big, splashy premieres. And Netflix would have brought that. But on the other side is that Netflix likes to say that it is doing just the same as all the other studios, and they are making big films with big filmmakers. And now they can't have that big splashy premiere that I'm sure filmmakers would really love at the world's biggest film festival.
Yeah, this has been an issue outside of Cannes where, you know, auteur filmmakers like to see their films in theaters. And Netflix has done a grudging little version of that, but not enough nearly to satisfy somebody like, I would think, Paul Greengrass. So it's a source of tension. And Amazon does allow theaters to play their films before they are streamed. And I think it's a better strategy. I don't quite understand the rigidness of the Netflix policy because I feel like, you know, you hear of Manchester by the Sea and you might see it on Amazon and think, I really meant to go and see that and I'm going to watch it. I just think it seems to serve both sides, but Netflix clearly has its own ideas, and so that's the way it is.
Well, Amazon has a luxury there in that its primary business is not the making and distributing of film and television. Netflix is really dependent on that almighty subscriber number. They need those subscribers to keep going up, up, up to justify this outrageous amount of spending that they are making on original content. That's their entire business. So I understand why Netflix is keeping all of this content in its closed universe, but the balance they have to strike is they want the top level content. And to do that, you have to recruit the most talented people. And many of those most talented people like theatrical distribution. I mean, Steven Spielberg said, if it's on Netflix, it's a movie of the week. It's a TV movie. And that's not what he makes.
Yeah, that's
so
not what they want to hear.
That's the challenge.
Mm-hmm. I think this stands as a representation of the digital revolution coming to Hollywood because a lot of companies come here and think we're going to do this our way and we know how what our way is. And then they come into a Hollywood culture and there are clashes. Speaking of the meeting of technology and Hollywood, Disney is now starting ESPN Plus, its first streaming service, as we know, would be the first of many. And there's going to be a bunch of offerings, not, you know, some of the higher profile things. That will still be part of your $8 per month bundle that you have to have when you subscribe to pretty much any cable thing in the world, unless you go to something like a skinny bundle. This, however, is Disney's toe in the water. It costs $5 a month, $4.99. And they are hoping to drive all sorts of viewers from their app to their streaming service. And as you know, they're buying Fox, and this will be their new model. And we'll see how it goes. Do you think fans are going to go when huge sporting events are not there?
No, I don't. And I'm actually kind of baffled by the fact that they're launching this without a big lure to get people to try it out. I mean, I know that most of the sports rights deals they have are already tied up, and that, you know, they can't just put them exclusively on this app. They have to continue with the big games on the flagship. But you got to feel like they could have carved something out to make a big splash with this app. And instead, you have, you know, what, a Bobby Knight documentary. You have one Major League Baseball game a week. You have a lot of boxing. You have other stuff that really feels like B-level content. I know they say it's, you know, just the start. They're going to do a lot more. But it feels like an inauspicious start.
Well, we'll see how it works out. In other Walt Disney Company news, there has just been a ruling as we speak in Canada. This was brought by a woman whose name has not been revealed. She is suing, saying that she was victimized by Harvey Weinstein twice in 2000. The statute of limitations is not a thing in Canada, but what's more interesting to me is that she is trying to pull in Disney, because Disney owned Harvey Weinstein's company Miramax when this happened. Disney has fought against being pulled in, saying that, you know, the Weinsteins ran their own company and what did we know? And Disney has failed in that argument in a ruling out of this Canadian court. And I think it's a potential huge embarrassment for Disney if this continues, because if it is disclosed that they did know or were aware of issues with Harvey Weinstein or, you know, involved in settlements, whatever, you know, they just had to move John Lasseter out on leave that is probably permanent. And we hear reports of multiple complaints to HR. It will be a bad look for Disney if it turns out that this becomes exposed through this litigation.
Yeah, I think it's worse than a bad look. There could be potential liability. And Disney's effort to keep this confidential and those deals with Miramax confidential is very telling to me, because it suggests that there's something there that won't look good. And it may evidence that the company did know about some of this conduct that has been alleged at Miramax and then later.
Yeah, when Disney no longer owned it because they fired the Weinsteins and got rid of them. Of course, Disney is saying this will reveal some secrets. The judge is going to allow them to do some redactions on whatever they have to produce, but not a bunch, just, you know, certain things. So, yeah, it looks like a tight squeeze for Disney. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Near the beginning of the new comedy Blockers, three parents, played by Leslie Mann, Ike Barinholtz, and John Cena, send their three daughters off to senior prom. One of the girls just happens to have left her laptop open, revealing a text conversation among the best friends.
Yeah, great. What do they say?
Okay, so there's something about an eggplant handshake.
Eggplant agreement.
Yeah, they got an agreement to make eggplant parmesan.
No, eggplants are teenage emoji language.
What?
You know what? That's true. Julie told me that the emojis have, they all have secret meanings. Mm-hmm. So like trees are weed and snowflakes are cocaine. And that thing is Yas Queen.
Yas Queen!
What the hell's that?
You've never heard of Yas Queen?
No.
All right, Grandpa.
After a few more rounds of emoji decoding, the panicked parents realize their girls have made a pact to lose their virginity on prom night. They set out to foil that plan. Blockers plays like a raunchy comedy, but it's surprisingly thoughtful. The young women are no dummies, and two of them are confident about their sexuality, while the third friend is still figuring that part out. The parents, on the other hand, get into all sorts of trouble in their rush to shut down their daughter's plan. Blockers is directed by our guest today, Kay Cannon. She's got many comedy writing credits to her name, including 30 Rock and the Pitch Perfect movies. Blockers is her directorial debut.
So before 30 Rock, mm-hmm. you were an improv.
I was an improviser. I was a performer. I did Second City.
Right. Which is a great training ground for so many
people.
Yeah,
and I did Boom Chicago out of Amsterdam, which like Jordan Peele and Ike Barinholtz and Seth Meyers did.
Yeah. So when you did that, and does that lead you to 30 Rock?
Yeah, because I met Tina. At the time, I was dating Jason Sudeikis, and he and I were both doing improv in Chicago, and we were doing The Second City, and we became friends. And so I started to write for myself because I was auditioning for things and not getting them as an actor. And I tested for Saturday Night Live and did not get it.
The pain. That's a hard one, right?
It is. Looking back, I wish I would have been more prepared. I think when you're like at Second City, it's very different than The Groundlings. Like at Second City, it's an ensemble feel. You don't have like characters and impressions at the ready. So I remember I did Laura Bush, and I remember holding a Laura Bush wig as I was waiting to go on, and I did Shakira. But it was the year that Kristen Wiig got hired. So if you're going to lose out,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was just sharing like kind of off the cuff. I had no agenda. I would just share the stuff I was writing with Tina. I really honestly did not think like, oh, Tina Fey is going to have a show and then she's going to eventually hire me onto the show. And then 30 Rock came about and she was like, do you have something else besides this pilot I wrote with my friend Karen? And I was taking a sitcom writing class and I was doing a spec of The Office. I was like in week 6. And I was like, yeah. Of course I've got it.
Right here.
And of course I did not have it. I had to like write all night long. And I'll never forget it. I did write all night long. So I was in New York. I sent the script. I got on a plane to LA, got off the plane, and then had a call that they wanted to bring me in.
I know you go from that to writing. You wrote all 3 Pitch Perfect movies, but yeah. I'm not sure if there's a stop along the way.
After the second season of 30 Rock, myself and Brownstone Productions, which is Elizabeth Banks and Max Handelman, we sold Pitch Perfect to Universal. And so in the third season, I was writing Pitch Perfect while at 30 Rock. And I would just write on the subway and write on the weekends. And I just worked. I mean, to be on a personal note, I was going through a divorce during the third season. So I felt like I was married to 30 Rock and writing Pitch Perfect. Like, I just sort of threw myself into work.
It can be very handy.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, it's like, it was a good thing in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And so I had enough time to do all that stuff. So in the third season, I wrote Pitch Perfect, and then it didn't shoot until the fifth season.
So when you start doing that, obviously the most striking thing is that somebody pursued you to direct.
Yeah.
Were you thinking, I really want to direct?
Well, I really thought that I was going to direct something I created for television. I had the show Girl Boss on Netflix.
Right, on Netflix.
And I really wanted to direct episodes of Girl Boss, and Netflix has a no showrunner can direct policy in their first year. So I didn't. And I thought, well, if I get a second season, I'm definitely, like, they were like, we guarantee we'll let you direct in the second season. It's a good policy, actually, because I couldn't even imagine, like,
you were just
when I would have had enough time to do that. Yeah. And I learned so much from the shadowing the directors that we had on the show. So that's where I thought it was what I was going to do.
Let me pause on Netflix for half a sec. I know that people didn't, I never saw Girl Boss. It came and
you
went.
You are many people who did not.
I'm one of them. Well, a little overwhelmed. Yes, it's peak TV. I can't do it. But the Netflix, I thought, you know, for a while there, it was like, come here and we'll give you 2 seasons. And the back end won't happen because we're not selling it in syndication, but right. You'll get the 2 seasons. But then they didn't give you the 2 seasons.
They didn't. We were one of the first ones that they didn't give to. I think we had this sort of crazy perfect storm where the CEO said we were going to start canceling shows. Mm-hmm. Girl Boss is about the real life of Sofia Amorosa, who created Nasty Gal and went from being this like dumpster diver, shoplifter, college dropout within 6 years, having a $280 million personal, you know, net worth and 350 employees. And Nasty Gal filed for bankruptcy 3 weeks before we came out.
Oopsie.
And there was a little bit of bad press in terms of some things that had happened with Sofia and the company. I mean, every first season is like, you know, you figure your stuff out.
Yes, sure.
So I accept that the flaws of the show. You may just not like the show. I get that totally. But in almost all the reviews, I mean, like really, like 99% of the reviews, it was talked about my mishandling of the protagonist and nothing else. They didn't say like it wasn't funny or whatever. But I don't know. I'm proud of it because I think I was just trying to tell a true story. This was what she was like. It's ingrained in us to watch flawed men.
I was going to say, is it because
terrible.
They could take it with a man and not a woman?
Or they thought it was an indictment on women. And there was many think pieces written about Girl Boss. I read them all. And I couldn't help myself.
Right. I'm not going to do that. I never read the reviews.
No, never. I read all of it. Because I think there's also something to learn from it.
Sure.
You know, like as you move forward and I just think that, like, us ladies are just not used to seeing flawed women that aren't, like, crying over a pint of ice cream. Do you know what I mean?
Right. They're, sad, a flawed woman.
Yeah, like, that she was a confident, sort of angry, flawed lady, and people, they thought it was an indictment on women, which I just wanted, I'm excited for the time when there are so many stories
right,
being told about weird. Women that yeah. it's not, like, a focus or anything. The one article that sticks with me is somebody said, like, Handmaid's Tale gets feminism right and Girl Boss gets it wrong. And I was like, oh, really? The show that where they have no rights whatsoever.
Right.
If that's how you get it right? Not the angry 23-year-old that we've all been there who finds her place in this life. So,
well, at least they didn't say it was funnier.
God, what if they did? Maybe they did. I should look back.
Really hurt. So, yeah, you have, and did Netflix kind of say we're going to give you 2 seasons or was
no,
it?
No, not at all. Never. Like, look, I'm so happy I got to do the show. Netflix was like the only place that would allow me to do a show like that. Like, I wasn't going to sell that show on a network.
Did you try?
Yeah.
And you weren't.
And failed. And okay. So, like, I was thrilled that we got to make the show. You know, do I wish the reception would have been different? Of course. But for their own reasons, they didn't give us a second one. And if they had given us a second season, I wouldn't have been able to do Blockers. You know, like,
right.
So there's
the door, the window.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And in a way, like, I think we did the first season when you watch it, and I know you will, because you're going to immediately from this interview, you're gonna going to go right and watch it. Like, you know, we kind of wrapped it up in a nice way at the end of the 13th episode.
Yeah.
We didn't know, but we...
But you wrapped it up anyway.
But we kind of, yeah, yeah.
So they come to you to do this movie, which must have been quite a surprise, I imagine.
Yeah. I had had lunch with Nathan Kahane at Good Universe a couple years before, and he was like, are you tired of other people directing your material? And I was like, you know what? I am tired.
Now that you mention it.
Now that you mention
I'm
it.
I'm outraged, actually.
Yeah. I'm throwing a salad across the room. And so he kind of got into my head. And then again, I thought I was going to do television, like I would
right.
direct television. And I wasn't surprised knowing that it came from Good Universe and Point Grey, but I was surprised I didn't have to do any kind of dance, that I didn't have to like prepare something to pitch to say like, this is why I think I'd be good
for
this.
You didn't have to do, this is my vision.
I didn't realize that they had brought me in. They had asked me to come in for like an all-lady writers panel for Neighbors 2. And, you know, when I say yes to anything like that, I like bring my computer, I've got lots of thoughts and whatever. And I had no idea that that was my audition. That was my dance. Like I'd come in and kind
just
of...
Just doing a panel on Neighbors?
Well, because I kind of took over the room a little bit, I guess. I didn't realize I had done that, you know? And when
you boss girled it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like I'm used to writer's rooms. Like I'm used to like doing that. And so I guess when I left there, they were like, oh, she should direct something of ours, and that became Blockers.
No, I have. Having said that, they didn't have like this great script ready for you to direct by it. It was called Cherries.
Well, it was on the blacklist, but
so
they
was,
had been working on it, so they had called it. They had renamed it the Pact, and they had already done some work on it.
Can I just say it was three girls and three dads, which I would sort of say like ick.
Yeah, and I think that Point Grey and Good Universe thought that too. When I read the script, it was already two dads and a mom.
Okay.
What I was excited about was I was like, the writer in me came out and I'm like, oh, I know the take I have on this and I know the changes I would like to make and ideas that I had. And I thought the script was super funny. And so I said yes immediately. And then I met with all the producers. So it's basically like me and like 10 producer dudes.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Including my, because I didn't have time to do the rewrite. So I had hired my husband, Eben Russell, who we work a lot together. And so it was like Eben and then like 9 other guys. And I basically kind of went through the script and was like, this feels like it's written by dudes. Not only that, it feels like it's written by middle-aged dude. You know, like, this feels a little rapey. You know, like I would just be like, no, this doesn't feel right. And
right.
This is like the,
getting into
know.
The
yeah, yeah. And then we would have, like, big discussions and big debates and everything. And then, you know, like, Eben and myself had it for a long time, and we did a big rewrite. And a bunch of writers contributed to making the movie what it was, including Seth and Evan and Lisa Goldberg.
Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg
and Lisa Goldberg. And so we, you know, it has to feel like it's from the female perspective. I mean, and they knew that, which is why they hired me. I felt like the young women, the daughters just didn't.
They weren't real.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
I mean, but you made them very distinctive. And I don't think the coming out thing was part of it.
It wasn't. Yeah. That was something that we added. When I say we, I meant Eben and I.
One of the girls figuring out her sexuality.
Yeah. I was trying to think like what girls, I talked to my nieces who are teenagers and it was like, what's important? What's going on? Like, you know, trying to connect. And then I honestly like thought about myself with my girlfriends. Like I sat with the same girls for 4 years in high school and we talked pretty frank with each other.
Coming up after a short break, Kay Cannon tells us about the blocker's character that reminds her of herself. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to director Kay Cannon about her new movie, Blockers. The R-rated comedy follows three best friends and their parents over the course of one very chaotic prom night. The three high school seniors, Julie, Kayla, and Sam, are played respectively by Catherine Newton, Geraldine Vishwanathan, and Gideon Adlon. Julie is determined to sleep with her boyfriend on what she imagines as a very romantic evening. Kayla isn't seriously dating anyone, but decides that's no reason she shouldn't join in the sex pact.
I'm in. I'm having sex tonight, too.
Just like that?
Yeah, I mean, why not?
Because it's your first time, and your first time should be special and perfect.
Yours can be special and perfect. Mine is going to be tonight, and with that dude.
Connor Aldrich? Your lab partner?
Listen, my student-athlete days are over. Tonight is the beginning of my adult life, and for the first time, I can do whatever I want. So I want to go to prom, get drunk, get potted up on weed, and lose my goddamn virginity.
The sort of jock girl, I guess, she has a freeness to her that I don't think I've seen in a character on screen.
That's really interesting that you say that, because she was already named Kayla. My name's Kay. I didn't name her Kayla, like, in my likeness.
After yourself.
But we are very similar. Like, I was an athlete growing up and very disciplined, but also confident and would say whatever and, like, you know, mouth of a truck driver. And there were a lot of lines that Geraldine, who plays Kayla, who's awesome in it, she'd be like, just tell me how you want me to say it. And I would say it how I would say it. And so I think that's interesting that you say, like, I don't know if you've seen that before, because that's probably true, because I don't know if I've seen someone like myself in a movie before.
I mean, I've seen, you know, nervy girls or whatever, but I haven't seen that level of confidence and just saying what you want and knowing what you want and
Yeah.
So when you finally were there, well, you prepped the movie, obviously, but when it's like really your show.
Yeah.
Did you feel like I got this? That confident jock girl?
Yes. And the no part of me I was able to hide. You know, like that's part about being an athlete is like putting on your game face and like, you know, acting like everything is okay. Yeah, fake it till you make it.
Because if the crew smells fear, I think it's bad.
Yeah. Now, I had worked with my DP, Russ Alsobrook, was the DP at New Girl. So we had known each other and I felt pretty good going into it. And I had done so much work on the script, and this may sound so stupid, but it was like, I was kind of worried about like how I was going to say action. I know that's so dumb. That is so dumb. And that really minimizes like what a director actually has to do. And then I don't even say it. Like I had my first AD say it.
You need to delegate. It's really important, right? It's part of the job.
Yeah. But it wasn't like an easy shoot. I had a lot of storylines. I had a lot of actors. You know, we did a lot of alt jokes.
When you say alt jokes, like a different
new
variation.
New jokes that I was throwing in, like once we got what was on the page. And then there was improvising, which I encouraged, which I really liked a lot. But there was also just sometimes we'd rehearse a scene and it wasn't working and there was rewriting in the moment. I mean, it was a lot of pressure. It wasn't easy. I might be wrong about this. We shot for 9 weeks, but 5 weeks of the nine were night shoots. Oof. Which wasn't great.
No, I would hate that.
I was away from my daughter for some of it. it was challenging.
Yeah. So the issue of consent, you wanted to make sure there was consent to any sex act because these girls are planning to have sex. They can't drink before they agree.
Yeah.
I mean, was there anything? So you know, the girls had to be very clear. Yes, I am consenting. I'm sober. I'm consenting. Was there anything where Universal said, no, too far, can't do?
No, I don't remember them saying no. I mean, I'd get a lot of notes to cut jokes they felt were too crass coming out of the girls' mouths. Like every time we met to talk about notes, and when we test the movie, I always, you know, I record the laugh track.
Yeah,
listen. And I would constantly do that. And I was like, you know, they would say, oh, it just doesn't feel like that's what they would say. It's like, oh, that is what they would say. I feel like I learned so much because I'd never done anything rated R before. And I've learned so much from those guys who do rated R movies. But I think they probably would admit that they equally learned a lot from my sensibilities and from my point of view and having not worked with a lot of ladies.
Yeah, listen to the women.
Yeah.
Gotta listen to the women.
Yeah.
So Molly Ringwald wrote a piece in The New Yorker recently looking at Breakfast Club, mm-hmm. right? Through the eyes of...
And 16 Candles.
Right. These two John Hughes giant hits that she was in.
Yeah.
Through the eyes of a woke woman in the Me Too era.
Yeah. My thoughts?
Yes, ma'am.
I have many because my love for John Hughes is so deep. You know, I set blockers in Chicago because... I mean, I'm from Chicago.
Tribute?
So, yeah. And I thought Molly's piece was extremely fair. And I thought it was great. Like, I thought that she was just... looking back, as we all should, at art, where you could look and see someone like John Hughes, who did so much good in that teenage stories weren't being told. There certainly weren't female protagonists. Like the fact that in Pretty in Pink, she was like from a low-income home and it was all about her and it was about what she thought, what she cared about. All those things are wonderful and we shouldn't deny that. At the same time, we have to accept that John Hughes had a huge blind spot and that you would hope that if he were still alive today, he would admit that. And that he is definitely a sign of the times back then. And I think about blockers where I'm like,
what are they going to look back at? Yeah, 35
years. Yeah, kind of. Yeah, where you're like, you know, my husband was joking. He's like, vaping. Like, what if we find out vaping is just the worst thing in the world? And it's like, they were making jokes about vaping.
Right.
You know, like, so John Hughes was, for as sensitive as he was and for as like progressive in a lot of ways that he was also like, sexist and, you know, or didn't understand. He just had the blind spot where he didn't understand that that would, when a woman is asleep, that that's technically date rape, you know, like as happened in 16 Candles. And 16 Candles is the one movie of John Hughes where I'm not a huge, huge fan. Like it came out before I was at the age to really like it. But also I think I just, when I did watch it, I think I just didn't, there was something inside me that knew that I didn't like it when he put the underwear up. Yeah, like there was like things where I was like, ah.
So it's always painful when you look back. Either the artist has turned out to be a terrible person or the art is flawed that way. And you feel like, damn it, I really like this. Am I still allowed to really like this?
I know.
Are we still allowed to like Pretty in Pink? And
I think so because, well, I hope I'm defending in the right way here because I only care about how Molly Ringwald felt as she looks back on this, but she doesn't imply that he was bad to her.
Right.
You know, it seems like he cared and he listened to her. I think she has a lot of love for him. So if that was a different story, then it's like, yeah. I don't know if I can look and, you know, watch these movies with any kind of love, but I don't know. It's complicated.
And it's a question of what you show your kid and what do you say if you do. And I remember showing Marx Brothers to my daughter and I completely spaced on this incredibly racist thing in this movie. And I was like, that was a different time. It was not okay.
But isn't it a great thing to learn from? Because I would, when I show my kid these movies, and I definitely will, I'll be like, let's talk about it. Like, this isn't the right way. That's not the right way to act. Like, that's disrespectful. And that's, at the time, that was okay. And we fought to learn to...
Well, she's young.
When
she gets to the teenage year, she won't watch movies with you anymore.
Oh, no.
Get it in quick. Kay Cannon is the director of Blockers. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.